Let's come back to what we're appreciating, that the dynamic of time is a primal force in the universe. It is the first dimension. As it has movement, the movement has curls within it, and as those curls occur, space blossoms out of time. And at a higher curl, you will have a phenomenal jump in capacity. The first curls are like the emergence of leaves out of a stalk. And the higher energy is that the leaves curl even tighter and become flowers. So that time-space can flower if the energy is high enough. But if the energy is raised even further, what happens is that the entire structure becomes crystalline. It becomes transparent. So that one can look to see if you can calibrate yourself to the dynamic of primordiality of time, to the blossoming of space as leaves, and to the intensification to the flowers, there is a further jump in that capacity, so that everything becomes transparent to you. You are able to look through, and when you look through, that dimension is consciousness. So that consciousness is a transparency that occurs because the energy is high enough, but you would have had to flower before you could do that. And before that, you would have to have leafed out. One of the most significant of all the primordial illustrations from ancient Egypt is of the Persea tree. And the goddess Seshet is writing with a stylus the name of someone who has died. And if their name is inscribed on a leaf of the Persea tree, they will be included in the cycle of living forever. And behind Seshet is standing Thoth, and he is inscribing on his tablet. So that Thoth writing makes the name spiritually real. Seshet writing the name on the Persea tree leaf makes the parallel become a complementarity, so that this person now is able to live forever like their name, on that level of the name. The Osirian seated figure provides the amphitheater of the context in which this can be real. So that Osiris, as a god of resurrection, makes the complementarity of the sacred hieroglyphic name written by the god of wisdom have a complementarity to the name of life written by the goddess who protects life, Seshet. So that life and light become complementarities when the amplitude of the divine is able to give them a cosmic range. That on that cosmic range, that spectrum, is like the magnetoelectric spectrum at 20 billion times the energy of the electromagnetic spectrum. So that one has, in effect, you have a life, but when your spirit is awakened as a beginning of the dimensions of consciousness, that's like a super light, which can be lifted to a third stage, which is a hyper light. The hyper light is able to have a concourse through the universe because it is transparent to it. Time and space are not barriers to it whatsoever. And so interstellar, intergalactic, interdimensional travel is on a hyperspace level, which has about 10 dimensions. And next year in 2010, when we go through the compressed development of how to develop a nine-dimensional complementarity, which then, because it's fertile, yields the achievement of a 10-dimensional hyperspace. We have looked at two examples from the widespread arms, the Irish Sea to the Bay of Bengal, and how the same symbol, the double pillar with the connecting arch, that this is the motif then that's in every cathedral in the Christian world. It's the baldachin that stands over the altar. And the altar is consecrated and built because it is above a relic of someone who had achieved these dimensions, had become not only a saint, but had become literally a super life saint, able to deliver a mediumship like a prism of dispensing a super light through to this world, to people of this world. One receives a blessing. The important thing about St. Thomas, not only that he is related then to the founders of Glastonbury Cathedral in the west of Britain, and all of its connections through the Irish Sea, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Somerset, Cornwall, Wiltshire, all of those areas of ancient Britain, long, long before it was in England. The curious thing about St. Thomas is that he was a architect. And it's important for us to realize that in 2,000 years ago, someone who is colloquially called a carpenter, like Jesus' father, Joseph, was a carpenter. It's not just a carpenter like you would get out of the Yellow Pages. Was someone who was masterful at the whole ecology of working with wood, which could be transferred also to working with stone. For one thing, the best wood in that area of the world at that time came from what is today Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon, the cypresses of Lebanon. An enormously capable wood for building. And the people who were good at using wood in a strategic way, in a radically new way, were the coastal people on the Mediterranean Sea. They were the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians are the first people to master the building of superior ships. They were able to take wood, timbers, and cut them in such a way that they were masterful at making ships, and sometimes very large ships, so that the longest trading routes in the world came from that section of the eastern Mediterranean. So that to be a carpenter was not to, just to be a carpenter, but you could be a shipwright, you could be an architect, you knew how to work, you knew how to grow the forests. You knew that the important thing here was that if you knew the techne, the Greek word for artist, techne, if you knew the techne of the use of it in a practical way, in a pragmatic way, but you used a prismatic design vision sense, now you're coordinating a prismatic with a pragmatic, a prismatic consciousness with a pragmatic know-how, and that these two hands together form, if it is on a world level, the old way of doing it was this. You use the practical to bring things together, and you use the prismatic to distribute them out, so that you have something which cycles in, like the moon, and something which radiates out, like the sun. This is why if you look at any Tibetan tanka in the Vajrayana, you will see up in one corner the moon and the other one the sun. That's what a tanka will have as its like consecration. It is the two pillars, the pillar of severity and the pillar of grace, that form one of the cards in the major arcana of the tarot deck. The priestess sits between the white pillar and the black pillar. That tarot deck, major arcana, is one of the resonant sets that comes. It originated about in the 300s AD, and originally was not in the form in which we have seen it in the last several hundreds of years. That transformation took place in the Renaissance. One of the curious things is that there is a major arcana card in the tarot called the Hermit. This peaked cap like this was originally a Phrygian cap. Phrygia was a province of what is today Turkey. Here's the lantern. Here's the staff. And we find that this figure appears on a coin. I've blown it up so you can see. Here's the peaked cap. Here's the lantern. Here's the staff. This is in the major arcana of the tarot deck. This king's name was Gondopheres. And Gondopheres is the first person that St. Thomas built a temple for in India. He was a king in the northern part of India, which is today Pakistan. And this coin was found not very far from where Lahore is. In fact, the coin is in the Lahore Museum, Antiquities. The way that he got to India is one of the great sleights of hand examples of the way in which Jesus sometimes worked. He received communication from that time. That part of India was called Gandhara, and it stretched from the Indus River all the way into northern Afghanistan through the Khyber Pass, and there was a pass north of that that would go in there as well. Asking for someone who could build a spiritual temple for him. And the reply was that I have a slave who's a master architect, and you can purchase him from me, and I will send him to you. And so St. Thomas was sent in a very special way to India. And the way that he went is quite interesting. He went on a trade route that left from the Phoenician coast, the two big ports that were there from Phoenician times early on were Tyre and Sidon. Sidon was the shipbuilding capital, and Tyre was the trading capital. All of the Phoenician trade routes that went the 2,000 miles of the Mediterranean Sea 3,000 years ago were made, the ships were made in Sidon, and they were posted out through Tyre. And the Phoenicians were such very good navigators and tradesmen because they never were conquerors of any place that they went to. They went as businessmen saying, we're here to help you share in our making money. We're all going to make money together because we have access to customers over a huge area. And if you're good at making these things, we can sell many thousands of these things over this huge area that you would never get to. And the way this works, we take a commission for helping everybody get rich. One of the cities that was founded by the Phoenicians became the city that is today Marseille, in southern France, 600 BC. That was made successfully because a city that they made on the African coast called Carthage, founded in 800 BC, was so successful that the people in Gaul, in France, on the Rhone estuary said, we want in on this. We now know that the Phoenicians were such great businessmen. They went out through the Gibraltar into the Atlantic Ocean, and they were the first people to be able to navigate large shipping commercial fleets on an ocean like the Atlantic Ocean, very stormy sometimes. Phoenician trading ports were always favored to be little miniature outposts that resembled their home base port, Tyre. Because Tyre did not have a harbor on the mainland, it had its harbors on the east side of an island just offshore. And so you can always tell archaeologically that these are Phoenician ports because they favored little islands off the mainland. We're not going to interfere with the way you guys are working your kingdom, but we're going to help you get the finances so you can do whatever you want to do. And all we need is to anchor our ships every so often on these little ports on this little island off the shore. The furthest down the Atlantic African coast that they went was now called Senegal. And the Paris of Africa is Dakar. And there's a little island off Dakar. And that's where the farthest Phoenician shipping port. So that the Phoenicians became some of the wealthiest people in the world, because they had these trading routes. And they went on through Spain and what is today Portugal, all the way up to the coast of what is today France, all the way over the English Channel, Atlantic to Britain. And the person who took advantage of this in a very big way, 1000 BC, was named Hiram. And he was the king of Tyre. But he needed to have a special kind of a financing because he wanted to expand his shipping fleet so that they not only went across the Mediterranean, but he wanted to have them so that they could come down to the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, to the Red Sea, and out to the Indian Ocean. Because this was a very lucrative trade route. Because that other trade route ran from Egypt all the way to India by way of Ethiopia. And Hiram heard about the fantastic riches of this trade route because a certain queen came to visit King Solomon, the Queen of Sheba. And the gifts that she brought were so impressive because she had all of the trade from Southern Arabia, from Africa, as well as from India. She had ivory and apes and gold and frankincense and myrrh and cinnamon and pepper. She had all the spices, all the jewels, all the valuable things that were almost impossible to get. You couldn't get it any other way. And nobody ran those trade routes except the people that controlled it in Egypt and in Ethiopia in kind of a combine. And their biggest supply was from people in India who prized blackness in human beings, whose demons were white, but whose blessed saints were black. And so the exchange of Indian blacks with African blacks produced the Ethiopian people, who are a huge blend of India and Africa. And the Queen of Sheba in the Song of Songs, Solomon's time, about 980 BC, she said, "I am black but comely. And the king loves me." This quality of being able to trace things back and understand is not just something where you see similarities, but all of a sudden you find structures. Here's a structure of a cathedral, an archetype of a cathedral that is divided into 22 sites. The 21 cards of the major arcana of the tarot deck and the Fool card, which is a zero card. This particular arrangement of the major arcana of the tarot deck as the points in a archetypal cathedral, a cosmic archetype of every and any cathedral, so that if one knows the major arcana of the tarot deck, one knows how to make the structure within which the minor arcana, the four suits, are able to be the life blood of the people utilizing this cathedral from this archetype. If you lift this archetype out of the building and you put it into motion, its motion will be that of an esoteric caravan. And if you take the major arcana of the tarot deck and you make each card in the tarot deck a wagon, you now have a caravan of 22 wagons that are able to move anywhere in the trading world. And this is how the gypsy wagons come from India all the way to Britain, because the gypsies are of this kind of hermetic link. And that one of the earliest, there's a beautiful book on it done by Gertrude Moakley, who was the librarian for the New York Central Library about two generations ago. It's called the, I'll bring a copy next week, the Caravan of the Tarot. What is interesting is that also, because this is a cathedral, because these are locations, one can now have a rearrangement of the presentation of what a cathedral does, because you have the archetype, it can be any place, and not only a caravan, which is esoteric, but it can be a caravan that carries the prototype of the transformation mass with it. And this design actually is in a book on the medieval miracle plays. And the miracle plays were such that they were in cycles, especially in Britain, that would be presented in cycles, and they would have the players have their little plays, and each cart would have its little bunch of actors and actresses to do this miracle play, and over a year, one would see the enactment of a whole season's cycle of the year of the esoterica, which lifted it out of the cathedrals and put it into the towns. So that the townspeople would have their version of it, the popular version of it. Because the wealthy and powerful owned the cathedrals, but the townspeople were free to participate with miracle plays. And it's out of miracle plays, finally, that you came to have a new idea that instead of just having different groups going around to different places, you could have a building that you could rearrange the sets for different plays in the same building. So that the medieval miracle play evolved into the Elizabethan theater. And it's interesting because E.K. Chambers, who did two volumes on the medieval theater, then did four volumes on the Elizabethan theater, and found that the real genius in this was indeed Shakespeare, not only because he could write the plays and envision the actors of the plays, the characters, but he was one of the great businessmen of all time. And he got close to a man named Burbage in London. Shakespeare started off in the most menial thing. He parked the horses. People would come to the plays and they would ride in on their horses, and Shakespeare was the groom parking lot attendant for the horses. And they found out that he could talk to anybody because he had one of the most brilliant characters, not just a mind, but he was kaleidoscopic as a man. And he talked, the owner of this theater, he said, "You're dealing with small potatoes because you're using an old-fashioned building. You're not taking advantage of the full spectrum of what is happening here and what can go on." And so old Mr. Burbage and his son, young Mr. Burbage, said, "Well, what do you recommend?" He said, "That we take apart this theater and we add new timbers and we go across the Thames over to Bankside and build a new theater there based on the full spectrum of this thing, and we'll call that theater the Globe, because we are now dealing with the entirety of the world. 200 years ago we dealt with the 28 types of people who rode to Canterbury Cathedral, and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales are all these types of people. To give you the full spectrum of humanity, Shakespeare said, we're going to use the whole globe. And so the globe was built especially so that it was like a super cyclotron. It was not only round, but it was spherical. And over the stage was a zodiac, the 12 signs of the zodiac, so that whatever happened on the stage for the audience was happening for the actors in a cosmic way. They were the go-betweens between the cosmos and the populace. So that the globe was a great tying of a bow of an architecture that transformed the way in which people had access to divinity, through the prismatic kaleidoscope of their own humanity, their own characters, raised to a high art of the vision of a play. And towards the end of his life, Shakespeare realized that he needed to go back to the origins of the way in which this transformative pre-Christianity, before it was called Christianity, when it was still Jesus' way. And so his last plays are all about the way in which the beginnings of the Holy Family in Britain are. And I'll bring next week a number of the plays. The most famous of them, of course, King Lear. And King Lear is the son-in-law of Anna. King Lear married her daughter, Penarden. And what was transferred to Penarden from Anna was the Grail from the Last Supper, the one that young Saint Mark used to serve in the upper story of his parents' house in Jerusalem. And when it came time, when Penarden had children, she had a daughter named Branwen, and she had two sons. One was named Bran the Blessed. And the Grail passed to Branwen, who married a king of Ireland. And about that time, Penarden was stolen from King Lear and forced to be the new live-in concubine slash forced wife of this powerful king. So that the wounded fisher king in the Grail myth is King Lear, who is sexually cuckolded permanently, could never reclaim Penarden, whose right then to keep the Grail in line showed up because Branwen was mistreated by this Irish king, who found out that there must be a flaw in their destiny that this could happen, and literally turned her from a cherished wife queen into a scullery maid. It's like the Cinderella story in reverse. So that her older brother, Bran the Blessed, mounted an expedition of warriors and went to Ireland and brought her back, but it was such a catastrophe because of the bloodshed that when they got back to a place called Holyhead in Wales, she died of heartbreak of having inherited this impossible situation. King Lear tragically went to France and had three daughters there by a second wife, and that's the story of Shakespeare's King Lear. But you'll find in Shakespeare other plays like Cymbeline, and we'll talk about them next week, all at the end of his life of realizing that there is something which is almost mystically tragic in the British Hebrew connection. This artifact is one of the most esoteric there is in the world. It's owned by a friend of mine, Sir Harry Hicks, whose family owned the land that Glastonbury was built on, and a great deal else in England. This is the marker for the burial of King Arthur at Glastonbury. He was buried there in 542 AD. It reads, "Here lies in a sepulcher the famous King Arthur in the island of Avalon. The Grail had to be taken out of Britain, out of Wales, out of Ireland, out of Scotland, out of that whole area. And so Bran the Blessed took the Grail all the way back to the Eastern Mediterranean. And that's where it became the Grail, which we have looked at here today. There is a interesting way in which fairy tales curl out of the way in which we're able to understand through the transparency. The Jewish trading route was different from the Phoenician. It went to Marseille, and then it went up the Rhone River. It went up as far as just south of a town named Vienne, and over a little tributary to a valley which has, today it's called Fermanagh. And in Fermanagh is a little portage that leads from the tributary of the Rhone to a tributary of the Loire River. And one can come from the Mediterranean up the Rhone, make a little portage, and then take the Loire all the way up through France to the Atlantic Ocean. And from there, it's just a couple of days sailing to the west land's end of Cornwall. At Fermanagh was built this church by Le Corbusier. It took 46 years to finally get it built. This church is built under a hill called Pilate's Hill, Pontius Pilate. This is where the Holy Family made their pilgrimage pivot, their portage, to get from the Rhone River to the Loire River. And in Fermanagh, Le Corbusier built four or five of his most powerful buildings. One of the things in France is that you find along the Loire River places like this fairy tale castle. This is the Sleeping Beauty Castle. The Sleeping Beauty archetype comes from Mary Magdalene, because Mary Magdalene was buried in the Cave of the Seven Sleepers in Ephesus, in what is today Turkey. And next week we'll talk more about the archaeology of Turkey, the archaeology of Britain, the archaeology of India, the archaeology of Ethiopia, and of Armenia, all focused around Alexandria. Alexandria was like the pivot for these five areas that were the farthest east-west, the farthest north-south, and a temporary place in Ephesus, which was very, very esoteric and very powerful. Ephesus had about 300,000 people at the time. It was one of the largest, most popular trading cities in the world, but it was famous for having a huge temple to the goddess Artemis, who was the sister of Apollo. The temple was 445 feet by 225 feet, one of the largest temples ever made. That temple was remade as the Temple of the Virgin Mary, and it was 853 feet long and several hundreds of feet wide, and was the largest structure, was one of the seven wonders of the world. The reason being, in Ephesus, like in the west of England, of Britain, is where another group went, including Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, the young Saint John. John was about 12 by the time that they went, and two of the other apostles, Saint Philip and Saint Nathaniel, and their wives. They were both married. Nathaniel is the one whose wedding was at Cana, where the water was turned into wine. He was a relative of Jesus' mother. He was like a second nephew to her. And that's why she had the water changed into wine at the wedding, because they ran out of wine. Philip was the best friend of Nathaniel because they were also related. And you find consistently that all of the apostles are related to each other through marriage and through a certain kind of, almost like a spider web. The wife of Mary, whose name is always remembered because he is one of the figures who goes to walk to Emmaus after the crucifixion. Cleophas is the father of St. Mark. He's the husband of Mary, but he has two brothers. One of them is Barnabas on Cyprus, who's the one to go fetch St. Paul and bring him on into his missions. But there was a third brother named Aristobulus, and the wife of Aristobulus was the mother-in-law of St. Peter, because St. Peter married her daughter, who died. And that's why in the New Testament you read that Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law, and then she served them. That was the wife of Aristobulus, whose brother-in-law was the father of St. Mark, and whose other brother-in-law was Barnabas on Cyprus, who ran that port of the shipping business across the Mediterranean. So they're all involved in enormous worldwide travel. And the people who ran the shipping from Egypt to India through the Red Sea and Ethiopia and the Indian Ocean, they were the Alexander Semitic family in Alexandria, and the two powerful sons in Jesus' time were Philo of Alexandria and his brother, whose name was Gaius Julius Alexander. He was reputed to be the richest man in the world. It's their father who financed the building of Caesarea, the port that was built by King Herod. So that you find that these Semitic families were not only intermarried and related, but they ran the shipping businesses from Ireland to India. Someone wrote a book on Jesus called A Marginal Peasant. He was a king of kings. More next week.